Welcome to the V&A Podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design. I'm Glenn Adamson, head of research at the V&A. In this episode, we'll be talking about museums and cultural diplomacy. At some time or other, you may have come across the phrase soft power, that is, global influence that is not strictly economic, nor military, nor even political in nature. Rather, soft power is cultural. It implies that a nation can achieve its goals through non-confrontational, persuasive means. There are many forms of soft power. Think of English language films, which are seen the world over, or music, which can cross language barriers to promote shared understanding. There is no doubt that art and design are another example of this type of cross-cultural communication, and as the world's greatest museum of art and design, the V&A has a special role to play when it comes to cultural diplomacy. How do we approach this vital part of our mission, and what are the pitfalls we might encounter on the way? Here to discuss museums and cultural diplomacy is Kirsten Bound, Head of International Innovation at the National Endowment for Science, Technology, and the Arts, or NESTA. And we are also very pleased to welcome to the podcast the director of the V&A, Martin Roth. So Kirsten, perhaps I can begin with you. What is your understanding of the concept of cultural diplomacy?
Well, thanks very much. It's great to be here. There are, as you say, a million different types of cultural diplomacy, the ways in which culture can influence other countries' behaviours and actions. Sometimes calling it soft power makes it seem like it's fluffy or ineffectual, but actually this is a really powerful force. For hundreds of years throughout history, people have used arts, literature, performance and artefacts to shape other people's perceptions of their countries. From 1851, from the Great Exhibition, right through to modern day expos, from the way that the Thai government funds restaurants around the world as a way of spreading Thai culture, something the Taiwanese have recently copied in a gastro diplomacy program. So, you know, it's not just about Thai culture and sharing artifacts between museums, but also you can think of the examples of mundane music. I mean, I don't think the Korean government would ever have expected K-pop to have such an influence on the global media. I mean, I think everyone can do their Gangnam Style dance, which you might not have expected a few years ago.
That's really interesting, Kirsten, partly because it makes me realize for the first time that the V&A is, among other things, an archive of cultural diplomacy, artifacts that were used just in this way as a form of soft power in earlier times. But before we get on to that, can I just ask you to explain a little bit about your own role at NESTA and, in fact, to tell our listeners what NESTA is?
NESTA is the UK's Innovation Foundation. So we're a charity that tries to help bring ideas to life. And we do this through a mixture of investment, research and analysis, and also practical experimentation of new ways of supporting innovation. So both in terms of driving economic growth, but also solving social challenges and helping boost the creative economy in the UK. So I am head of international innovation. I am really interested in looking at how ideas move and are exploited around the world. So in particular, I'm interested in looking at how emerging economies and the rise of emerging economies is shifting the global innovation system and really what this means for countries like the UK.
Okay, fantastic. So Martin, director of the V&A, of course, you've had plenty of opportunity to reflect on the purposes of the museum. When you hear the institution described as a tool of cultural diplomacy, does that match your ideas?
I mean, I think it's a kind of dichotomy. It's two sides on the same medal. Think about all the great collections that we have in Europe that somehow, I hate to say it, are looted art. Think about the Louvre, think about other museums. That has, at the same time, all the potentials to bring people together, coming out of difficult times, coming out of conflict zones, coming out of, let's say, sometimes even of wars. But if you think how museums served in the Cold War to bring people together, starting this kind of cultural diplomacy, what happened with the Soviet Union in terms of museums, even in the 50s and 60s already, the first exhibitions that were made from Britain, from Germany, from the US, in Moscow, helped to create a new understanding in difficult times. And talking about the V&A makes it even more feasible. If the British Museum is somehow the child of the Enlightenment, then the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum, is somehow the grandchild of the Enlightenment. Means that idea of Prince Albert was definitely important in times of social difficulties all over Europe, times of revolutions, and they needed institutions to bring people together. that idea of creating the World's Fair, the Great Exhibition in 1851, was a beginning of a new era. And the V&A is the legacy of it, is the offspring of that idea. Means meeting in a free and open space, talking to each other, even in times of conflicts. Mm. And part of that legacy, part of that information is still sitting in our genetic pool of our collection. Means we work with other museums all around the world. We have a collection that comes all around the world. We have a collection that is made for everyone. We have a collection that is easy to understand if you explain it in a way, because it's always related to the daily life of people. Even if it's Renaissance or medieval art, whatever it is a daily life-based approach.
So that's a little bit about where we come from and the broad picture of the museum. In your role as director, when you come to the museum in the morning, do you think about what you're doing as a cultural diplomat? Do you see that as a big part of your role?
The way I described it, I think it says that I have my difficulties with that notion. If you do it on purpose, if you use it as a pool for political reasons, then it's not working. It is content-based. It has a strategy. It has a vision. It is related on objects. It's related on research, on science. But it has not a political strategy as a headline. Then we are a political institution and it doesn't work that way around.
So you think of the implications of running a museum like ours rather than the museum as a specific tool of implementation?
No, I think it's even less complicated. I think it has to do with the strategy that we have for our exhibitions, for our research program. It's the daily life of a museum. And if you combine that daily life of a museum, that purpose, that strategy with other museums around the globe, that's the kind of platform that you create. Trust, confidence, and you build on that platform and you can do more together. I mean, we have a lot of examples that we can use, just what we did with China in the last 15, 20 years in the V&A, but also in other museums around Europe that helped to build confidence and trust.
Kirsten, when you hear Martin describing this role of the museum, what do you think as an outside observer to the sector?
Well, I started working on the theme of cultural diplomacy in about 2006, 2007 at Demos with a chap called John Holden, who's done some great work in this area. For me, it was being exposed to just the incredible range of relationships and activities which our cultural institutions have around the world. A visitor to a museum would never perceive of how much behind-the-scenes work is going on in terms of exchanging collections, capacity building, training, or just exchanging of ideas. So I think it is an incredible behind-the-scenes network which the UK has. It was interesting the point you raised about being a tool or an instrument for political will. And I think that's a really interesting question. I think in the UK, we have got a very different position to some governments in the way that they use their cultural artefacts and institutions. You know, take even the French, where I think there's a much closer relationship between culture and politics, historically because of Francophonie, because of lots of reasons. So I think we have a privileged position in the UK where we do have a set of very autonomous cultural institutions that themselves maintain a very powerful international network that benefits the UK.
It's just the sheer existence. I mean, the reason our raison d'être, the reason that we are existing, is part of diplomacy. It's just that you have to be really cautious if it comes to political expectations. I mean, even tourism, people coming from all over the world to London, learning more about what we are doing, how we see the world, how we think about our past, what we think about history, helps a lot to create a kind of common understanding. It's a common ground for people and to do more together.
And Martin, would you agree with Kirsten that the UK government is somewhat hands-off in terms of the content of the museums? You don't feel that there's pressure from the government for the museum to work in certain ways?
Glenn, this is a rather difficult and ongoing debate for, I mean, as far as I can remember. I mean, with my German background, I know that we always try to keep a distance to the government. And it was even the other way around. I mean, I started to work with the government in the late 90s, working together with the Foreign Office in China and other places of the world, because I learned if we do it together, we are more effective, we are more efficient. Sometimes it's just more fun. I mean, it's another outreach. But it doesn't mean that we have to... It's not a political instrument, you know. I don't really never felt misused. It's, as Kirsten said, in the UK it's even more. There's this arm's length principle that's everywhere and there's that distance. And I can't remember that there was one situation when I thought the government asked us to do something. It was exactly the opposite.
So, Martin, can we talk about a concrete example of cultural diplomacy in action at the V&A, which is this interesting exhibition we did about street art in Libya after Gaddafi was deposed?
Mm-hmm. I'm prepared to talk about it, but I think it's somehow a little bit misleading, because I think what we do in the V&A is a kind of everyday life cultural diplomacy, with all people from all over the world, tourists coming to the V&A, celebrating our own culture in the V&A. That's all part of that cultural diplomacy setting. But the Libya exhibition that we did in Tripoli and Benghazi was a very unusual one. The V&A has a great collection on street art, and street art was extremely important in the revolution against Gaddafi, if it was a revolution. We supported artists and people from the street who tried to protest against Gaddafi with paintings on the street during the nighttime, taking away during the daytime again. It was really a kind of fight going on with street art. So we made an exhibition with the help of the British Council in Tripoli and Benghazi that helped to create some kind of awareness. And it was extremely important, because it was not only military aid in this case, it was even culture that created kind of intervention. And I think it's important that we help in a very peaceful way. What's going on in Syria right now is pretty much the same. The V&A worked with Damascus for 160, 150 years. And I think we have to be prepared to do something right now in the refugee camps or somewhere else.
Kirsten, when you hear Martin describing situations like this where there are zones of active conflict, as well as zones where we would normally be in any kind of peaceful economic exchange, do you see a particular role for the museums there that perhaps they aren't necessarily practicing as often as they might?
I think there's definitely a case that museums and cultural organizations can reach parts that politics can't. But I think there's something very interesting about the role of not just those elite interactions between leaders, but also the interactions between our everyday life and a culture's everyday life in a completely different scenario, whether that being driven by conflict or a completely different set of religious beliefs or ideology. And I think particularly with the emergence of new technology platforms, there's a huge opportunity for museums to really be able to support and nourish, not control in any way, but nourish the interactions that happen within social media, using technology platforms as a way of reaching those populations. You know, we've seen the explosion of social media in China. We have Twitter, China has WeChat. It's in the middle of one of the biggest internet crackdowns on rumours in the world, but still that's a way to reach into Chinese culture and to have open discussions about issues. So I think that's another really important part to think about museums' role as connecting everyday life of populations around the world.
I suppose that's quite a recent phenomenon, because it used to be that to experience a museum you had to physically go there. But of course, in an age where museum collections are online, and so, for example, somebody sitting in Syria, if they do have internet access, can look at a million objects that are in the V&A's collection. That completely changes the picture.
Definitely. I mean, when we were writing our report for Demos back in 2007, remember we were celebrating the idea of Bebo and MySpace. And it seems so archaic to think of those tools now, when we know that a billion videos are uploaded on YouTube every day, that the reach of platforms like Twitter, I think it's incredible. I mean, at Nesta, that's one of the really important areas in which we're expanding our work, bringing together technologists, artists, cultural institutions and researchers to understand how you can use new platforms to expand your reach to audiences around the world. We've actually got a £7 million fund for R&D in the arts, which I would encourage anyone to apply to if they've got ideas of how they can, as technologists, work with cultural institutions to help them expand their reach to new populations.
If I may add two things. First of all, I think it's nothing new. It was always there. The cultural situation, or the situation of cultural institutions in the 21st century, that we have to explain why we are there and what we are doing. And I think that's so important that someone like Kirsten helped us in explaining the role in a bigger picture. And that role of the museum was always important for the society. The way we educated our next generation about other civilizations was always, I mean, we talked about tolerance, we talked about what we do against xenophobia and so on. That's something that always happened in a museum. It's part of our setting. But I think it's more important in the 21st century when we have to explain why we need the money to do things like that. So that's one part of it. The other explanation, at least for me, is the change of politics, the new world order starting in the mid-80s or late 80s. And I hope I can express what I want to say because it's a rather tricky topic. But I think somehow we've been like a cultural business card for the Western Hemisphere in order to go to those countries who've been far away for the last 50, 60 years and to explain that's where we come from, that's what we are, and that's what we're going to do. I mean, just imagine 20 years ago, it was nearly impossible to go to China and completely impossible to make an exhibition in China or East Germany, West Germany. I remember Caspar David Friedrich exhibition in the 80s, and I'm still convinced that helped to open the border. This kind of understanding on both sides on the Iron Curtain. And once the Iron Curtain came down and then the wall collapsed and so on, we needed this kind of dialogue. And it was easier to have a dialogue in objects than have just a political dialogue. So I think tourism and that cultural dialogue helped a lot to recreate an understanding of East and West after that new world order started. Mm-hmm. But that's 20 years ago. And I think we have now to find new methods how we work together in the future.
Kirsten, do you see any downsides to the idea that museums are working in this way, or the idea that art and design more broadly should be seen as instruments of cultural diplomacy?
I think it's, if someone would be considered an instrument, I'm sure no one wants to be considered an instrument by anyone else at all, but to be able to act as a channel for new discussions, new dialogues, new ideas to flow between different cultures. I don't see it as so much of a problem. And we were talking earlier about the idea of instrumentalizing culture, as certain governments tend to do. But I don't see it as a major issue.
So what would be a line that you wouldn't want to see crossed then? Is there a sense that there is a politicization of art and design that you would find problematic? I'm not saying that's what's happening in Britain now, but where would you draw that line?
I don't know. It's always been, art and design's always been political. I mean, that's what makes it fascinating, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the idea of the CIA sponsoring jazz tours in the 50s or sponsoring Jackson Pollock, you know, I find it completely fascinating that this was such an instrument in kind of Cold War diplomacy. But at the same time, I mean, would Jackson Pollock have considered himself an instrument of that? I mean, he was doing what he thought, doing what he wanted. So I think that there are interesting ways in which diplomats can think about how you can shape interactions using culture or using culture as a vehicle. But I'm not conscious of any kind of conscious politicization to particular ends that's happening in the UK at the moment.
I think we're still far, far, far away from a political influence. And I don't want to paint it in rose colors. I think it's just true. And I mean, I think I learned it from you when you said what happens in the world happens in the museum, Glenn. And I think that's the case. We are not terra incognita. We are not on an island somewhere, paradise and away from reality. We are reality, and we have to face that reality, and we have to talk about it. And I think we have the character, whatever, in our museums that combine the world in a certain way. I mean, creativity is creativity everywhere. It's not just a British creativity or European creativity. And to inspire creativity is a combining factor. And we have to use that in a very positive way in bringing people together.
So let me ask you the opposite question then, Martin. Do you think that the V&A, or are you as director at the V&A, trying to put the institution in a leading position when it comes to cultural diplomacy? Do you think that the V&A has a special role to play in this area?
It's part of our, as I said, raison d'être. And Glenn, sometimes, I mean, it happened before I came to the UK, but I remember that I had an invitation to go to Tehran, to Iran, and the German ambassador called me and said, please come, you are the only one who can come right now. Because there's definitely no politicians, and it's even difficult for CEOs to come. Come. If there's someone coming, then it's culture. And I thought at that time, I will never forget that is probably my job. And really in a very serious way, and you'd have to take that role and you have to accept it. But it doesn't mean that it's the major headline of a museum. Don't get me wrong after that podcast. It's not what I say. This is the only strand. That's one of the strengths that we have for just one. Mm.
So perhaps we could finish by talking about what might happen in the future. We've talked about the way that the museum preserves a record of cultural diplomacy from the past. Think about Chinese porcelains being sent to Europe maybe in the 17th and 18th centuries, for example. What about looking ahead? Kirsten, do you think that museums will become more important as, let's not say instruments, but as places where cultural diplomacy happens? Or do you think that economic and political constraints will arise that prevents us from doing our work in this area as effectively as we do now?
Mm-hmm. Big question. People who know a little bit about cultural diplomacy often think of it as using cultural objects to explain heritage, to explain where we come from. And I think there's a really interesting opportunity for the V&A to really help position what it's about what the future looks like as much as what the past looked like. Let me explain that. I think that's something about because where ideas come from. So there's a perception that ideas come from eureka moments, that they're, some guy in a bath or suddenly some idea pops up in your head. But, ideas actually come from a process of recombination, of recasting, remixing, interaction. So the collections which the V&A currently has, the exhibitions, the processes of design which it's exhibiting are actually, part and parcel of what the future looks like. So there's a very important collection of remixing ideas from around the world and actually showing us what the future will look like in this globalized scenario that we're looking at.
You don't think that set of possibilities or potentials is being endangered? You see it as growing and growing?
I see it as growing, yeah. I mean, there's responsibilities on all sides, right? There's a responsibility of the government to ensure that we continue to invest in our cultural excellence. We invest a lot less in culture. Even I, as someone who's very much an outsider to the cultural world, knows that we underinvest compared to lots of other countries. But there's also responsibility on the side of museums to really invest in understanding how new technologies, new platforms can allow them to reach new audiences and to think in entirely new ways about communicating these amazing ideas which are held within their walls and systems and archives.
Martin, can I give you the last word and ask you to speak perhaps very personally about this? When you look at the future, the V&A in particular, or museums in general, and this question of culture around the world, what are your hopes and fears?
I mean, how much time do we have? it's maybe two very brief remarks. The first one is, as I said, 20 years after reunification, war came down, and so on, the political changes. We need new strategies, and those new strategies are long-term strategies. We need different relationship to museums and research institutions in China and all over the world. In that time of amazing communication tools that we have right now, we don't need this kind of exhibitions that we created 20 years ago when we sent a Raphael to Beijing for 2 weeks. I mean, it's not true, we didn't. But it's just an example. But it was discussed quite often. Putin came one day and asked us in Dresden if we send the Raphael to Moscow. So it was difficult to say no. That's over. That's history. That's really the past. We need different methods. And I'm not sure if we found the right methods right now. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the V&A works on a museum in close to Hong Kong, in Shenzhen, a design museum, together with a group of our initiative from Shenzhen. So that long-term strategy, I think it's something for the future. But don't ask me, please, what I mean in detail, because I think that's something that has to be developed right now.
But the broad principle there is that we collaborate with institutions from abroad rather than just sending our culture to them.
I think we have to forget completely the national background. It has nothing to do with a national approach any longer. It's about knowledge. It's about sharing knowledge. It's about platform that we use together. And then we work together for different new topics. But if you ask me what are those new topics, then I have a problem. But I know that we need a different way to do it. That time is over. And there's a miracle with this future, because we always think the future is better, but only because we know the past. And we always pick the positive things in the past and think it will happen in the future. And Kirsten, what you said, I think that's right. It's a recombination. It's like a collage that we put together. And a museum has that different patterns of the past that we can rearrange for a scenario for the future. And I think the V&A is exactly made for that.
Okay, thank you both very much for that amazing journey through a very complex but obviously extremely important topic, how museums work as, let's again not say instruments, but let's say platforms or spaces for cultural diplomacy. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. This is the final episode of the first season of the V&A podcast. I will be leaving the V&A myself, taking up the directorship.
It's too sad.
Taking up the directorship of the Museum of Arts and Design in New York. But it's been a great pleasure to be with you and to host this podcast over the past months. And I think this has been a fantastic way to end. So thank you very much to Martin Roth, director of the V&A, and Kirsten Bound from Nesta. And we hope that you'll tune in for another episode in the next season of the V&A podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design.